This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
And when I returned to the Virgin Islands, my plan wasn't much better than the first round either. I had intentions of joining the police department.
Was there any type of language barrier for you?
In the beginning, I was confused, and the instructors made it perfectly clear that they weren't gonna alter their patterns of speech to accommodate me. So it wasn't like devastating, but it was definitely there were times that I was like, all right, I don't know what they just said. So, yeah. And then that same barrier, you know, understanding the island, there are street names to stuff. Nothing is marked. And so you get directions like head by the upside down tamarind tree, go up to what Padujuni does, fix the car, then take a right. And, you know, it was all like local references that if you didn't live there, you would never know what they were talking about. Yeah. You know what Padujuni does, fix the goat dim? That's the yard. You know, it's like when I started, you know, in patrol, I got the hang of that very quickly.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. You see, I'm doubling up on my guests this time. And if things work out right, this is going to be a total of four different episodes. Because let me tell you, these two guys, they've got some stories that I had a hard time believing. I know they're true, but I'm just sitting there with my chin on the desk most of the time when they're telling me the stories because of the things they went through and where they were when they happened. It's just unfreaking believable is what it is. But thank you so much for coming back every week to join us here. If you're listening to this on audio and you haven't checked us out on YouTube yet, do me a favor, go over to YouTube, type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the search bar, go down, hit the subscribe button, listen to a few episodes, hit the like button, and send me some comments. We're trying to grow YouTube big time this year, so do me a favor and go over and do that. And there's so many people that listen on the audio channels. If you guys would just come over to YouTube, it really helped Murph out, let me tell you here. This old man, I'm starting to think about, you know, down the road, I got to retire at some point. I just don't want to. And I have no plans to. So you might recognize one of these young men here. His name is Rick Rambo. Can you believe that? His real freaking name is Rambo. I think we did the same thing, Rick, the first time you were on here. Rick was a guest here on episode 123, which came out in November of 2023. And his stories took up a full 2 weeks. And that was back when we had my co-host Morgan Wright was still here. And I mean, Rick, you just had Morgan and I just sitting there going, this can't be true. You really didn't do that.
I'm still winded from that.
Well, Morgan will do that to you. I'll tell you right now. I miss having him on the show here because I don't know if you ever knew, but you know, he was a Kansas State trooper. And I nicknamed him AAA because I told him all he ever did was change tires and go get people gas. But luckily, he didn't kill me over that. But our other guest this week is an old partner of Rick's. They work together in the Virgin Islands. This is Chris Howe, 22-year law enforcement professional. Just wait. When I think of the Virgin Islands, I'm thinking tropical paradise. I've been to St. Thomas. I've never been to St. Croix. But here's a guy that joined the St. Croix Police Department, did 22 years there, made it all the way up to chief. And the things that were going down there make me never want to go back, honestly. So, Chris, welcome to the show. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you.
Good to be back.
Good to have you guys, man. I've been so excited for this. I didn't ask you if I could mention this, Rick, but I mean, Chris, but I know that you're writing some books, hopefully, that you're doing manuscripts anyway, but you're not publishing anything. And he was gracious enough to let me read one of them. I couldn't put it down. I'm a product of the West Virginia school system. I'm a slow reader, but I read this thing in 2 days. Well, it was only 8 pages, but no, it was a little more than that. But it was fantastic. You know, I immediately sent you an email when I finished that. I hope you do publish them someday because I think you've got some real, I don't know about the rest of them, but that first one, man, it grabbed my attention big time. So I guess everybody'd like for me to shut up so we can get our guest on here, right? But, you know, we're at the point with our small town police blotter. Before we get into that, we have a disclaimer. This is a show about crime. We talk about bad people. We talk about bad people doing bad things to good people. Now, we take our show very seriously. We always want to take advantage of that opportunity to have a laugh at the stupid criminals that are out there, don't we? But speaking of stupid, now, I sent an article to each one of these guys, and somehow I messed up and didn't get Chris's to him correctly. So Chris is just going to sit back and listen to us and make fun of us as we talk. Rick, my brother here, is up in Alaska, if you remember that. There's always something going on up there. So, Rick, I'm going to turn it over to you, brother. Tell us what's going on up there in Alaska.
All right. I'm going to go to the worst part of upper middle age, the reading glasses. All right.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah. And speaking of going to the way back machine, so we're going to go a little ways back here in Alaska history. We're going back to 1970. I think we were starting to get busy with the pipeline and all the shenanigans with that. But this is going to be an old one, old case. Good example of, like you said, dumb criminals that have been around a long time doing dumb things. On Friday night, January 16th, 1970, thieves made a successful haul when they broke into the Peninsula Medical Center in Soldotna and escaped with drugs. At least that's what the thieves themselves must have thought. A second look at their exploit, however, casts his, and I'm going to finger quote, success in a more dubious light. To begin with, the two burglars struck at 9 p.m. when most folks aren't in bed yet, and moreover, two boys had been hired to clean the upstairs of the medical center were still at work. Additionally, the burglars made so much noise in the process of their break-in that the cleaning boys could hear them over the sounds of their own labor. One of the boys locked himself in a bathroom for safety, while the other sneaked outdoors and downstairs to check on the disturbance. Seeing evidence of a crime in progress, the boy raced through the night to nearby home of one of the center's physicians, Dr. Donald P. Mersch. The boy led Mersch to the scene of the crime just as the first of the thieves were exiting through a first-story window. Mersch and the boy ducked out of sight, and the thief ran past them with his haul. A few seconds later, the second thief followed suit, giving the two witnesses an excellent view of both criminals. The Soldotna Police Department was notified and received solid descriptions of both perpetrators. Police Chief Russell Anderson then took a look at the damage and assessed the losses. After his inspection was complete, he told the local press that the evidence demonstrated, quote, the stupidity of drug users, unquote. If the perpetrators had any hope of inducing highs from their swag, he said, they were going to be mostly disappointed. Included in the thieves' haul was a small amount of mild tranquilizers. Other than that, the booty wasn't exactly a bonanza. A supply of penicillin in vials and some pre-mixed penicillin in disposable syringes. Three types of cortisone, various B-complex and B12 vitamins, and the piece de resistance, four to five types of estrogen.
Nice.
So that was the beginning. That was the end of toxic masculinity for Soldotna for about probably a week or two anyway. And there's your story from Alaska.
Oh, man. You know, it's just not indicative of Alaska. That happens all around the world, doesn't it?
Makes for a good singing voice anyway for those fellas, probably.
Yeah, the girlfriend's probably going to the guy going, what's wrong with your voice? You sound like a girl now. Oh, man. Thanks for reading that.
You're welcome.
As you know, as you guys know, there's never a shortage of dumb criminals here in Florida. I think we have almost cornered the market on that. I'm amazed at – I've got a monthly Patreon channel section episode. It's called You Can't Make This Crap Up. And it's an hour's worth of stupid criminal stories, not just from the United States, but from around the world. But Florida, just so much. There's so many more stories from Florida than like a lot of states combined. It's amazing. So I never have trouble finding topics here for the show. But in this one, this just happened last month. And you may have read about it in the newspaper. A day after claiming a $167.3 million Powerball jackpot, James Farthing was at the lobby bar of a Florida resort bragging about his financial windfall, walking around going, I'm a millionaire, I'm a millionaire, wearing only his shorts and sneakers. I saw a picture of this guy, and he is heavily tattooed. He looks like that big buffed actor that plays Aquaman. Which I can't remember his name, but
Jason Momoa.
That's him. Yeah. That's who he looks like. And this guy Farthing, he's 50 years old. I mean, he looked good for a 50-year-old, but he got a little ticked off when somebody overheard him and they started challenging him. This man, Kevin Rushing, now he's 48 years old. He's from Idaho, so he's probably a good old country boy. And he says, you know, this guy's just walking around claiming about all these lottery winnings, and we thought he was full of crap. And they were at the Tradewinds Resort in St. Petersburg Beach. St. Pete Beach is what we call it. And he called the guy delusional. Well, what happened after that was a melee. It resulted in felony and misdemeanor charges being filed against Farthing, a career criminal ex-con. Is that a surprise? I don't think so. And all this was captured on a police body cam video. So what happened is cops got called to the resort in response to the unruly behavior of Farthing and his girlfriend. The quote is, this guy with the tats was basically trying to fight everybody in the bar, according to a deputy sheriff. This guy came in acting like a a-hole. He's telling everybody he's a millionaire. I'm a millionaire. I mean, if you are, why would you, you know, do you need to stroke your own back, you know, your own ego? But anyway, after being called out, Farthing allegedly punched Rushing in the face. The men were grappling on the floor when the deputy rushed in to separate the pair. As the cop was detaining Rushing, Farthing saw an opportunity, got to his feet, and he tried to kick Rushing in the head. I mean, we've all seen that in fights, right? You get one guy under the control. The other guy thinks he's got a free shot. The problem is Farthing kicked the deputy in the face. Oops. So the deputy, what'd he do? He pulled out that taser, man, and you know what's coming. He was telling Farthing, he said, put your hands behind your back, you know, get down. I'm telling you, get up against the wall, whatever. And Farthing's like, not going to do that. Took off for a run, caught one of the tasers in the back, and he did the funky chicken there on the floor for a little while. Which, if you've never watched that, go watch one on YouTube. It's hilarious watching people do that. About that time, a second deputy comes in, and he executes a flawless tackle on Farthing, who was got his face a little bit bloody when he hit the floor with his because he'd just been tased, right? The deputy says, he said, you see, I have this guy in custody and you walk up and you effing kick me and hit me in the head. He said, I'm sorry, man, but I bet he was. I bet he was real sorry. And the deputy tells me, he said, say, save your sorries for later. I don't want to hear him. So Farthing was charged with battery on a law enforcement officer, a felony, and resisting, which is a misdemeanor. While initially charged with simple battery for punching, Rushing, the prosecutors dropped that charge. Farthing he's out free on a $10,500 bail because he's a millionaire, right? He's a multimillionaire. But I looked a little further, and he's already spent about 30 years. This guy's 50 years old. He spent about 30 years of his life behind bars. His court records since show convictions for tampering with evidence, engaging in organized crime, drug charges, receiving stolen property, and theft by unlawful taking. Some people just never learn, right? I mean, I'm guessing the guy is a tough guy. He looked like he could be in this picture, but he hadn't learned his lesson yet, has he?
Well, it sounds like he's off to the races. You know, you hear these stories about people who win the lottery big time and they spend it all, like $40 million. It's gone within 3 years. Well, he's off to a good start.
The only good thing I saw was that he gave a large portion of it, like half of his winnings, to his mom. So I thought that was admirable. But what a jerk. Anyway, guys, thank y'all very much for playing along. Chris, I apologize. I screwed that up. It's called Murphy's Law, and it's probably going to permeate everything we do throughout this entire interview. Just be ready.
Understood.
So let's go ahead and get into the backgrounds here. And let's start with Chris. We've had Rick on the show here, and Rick will cover your background quickly here in just a minute. But since this is Chris's first time, if you wouldn't mind, Chris, tell us where you grew up, what your family dynamics were, brothers and sisters, what mom and dad did, going through school, did you play sports, anything like that that you want to talk about?
Yeah, so I grew up in Michigan, right on the shoreline, the western shoreline of Michigan, and older brother, a couple years older than me, mom and dad both worked. Dad was into sales. Mom worked as a secretary for about 30 years or more and went to local high school here, just public school, and swam for a number of years, but did lots of other stuff as well, lots of extra school activities. So wasn't a great student at all. And that kind of got me to where I was. As far as law enforcement as well. So I did 2 years of college, but right after college, headed to the Virgin Islands. So
What were you studying in college?
Originally, when I went, it was just general studies. I got my associate's degree, and then after I became an officer, became a law enforcement officer, I went back and got my bachelor's degree in criminal justice.
Cool. So you didn't give up completely on that. That's pretty cool.
No, and I had engineering scholarships that I received when I was in high school that I never used. So my mom still reminds me of that today.
I bet she does. You gotta love your mom. They won't let you forget things, do they?
Yeah.
What did you get your 2-year degree in?
I was just a general studies associate of arts. Yeah.
And where was that at?
It was a community college in Western Michigan.
Okay.
And then for my bachelor's, I went to New York State. So I did it online.
Nice. Very good. So you went to the Virgin Islands. Where did that come from?
Well, when I graduated from high school, I had knew some older, some guys that were older than me that were musicians, and they traveled. They were kind of like snowbirds. They would go to the Virgin Islands during the winter and then come back to Michigan during the summer. And I'd heard them talk about it. And so when I graduated from high school, I decided just to tag along with them. And so I bought a one-way ticket. I had really no money to speak of. So I pretty much depleted my entire savings with the ticket without a real plan of what I was going to do when I got to the Virgin Islands. So as soon as I hit the ground, I started looking for a job, and I got a job with a company that was called Caribbean Sea Adventures, and it was owned by a British couple, and they were doing like snorkel, dive, and sail trips. They had like 14 boats at the time, and I got a job on crewing on those boats, and I did that for a year.
Did you have any background in the being on the ocean or being on the lake or being on a boat?
The Great Lakes. Yeah. I worked on boats in the Great Lakes, but they really hired me as a snorkel guide. And the interview was like, can you swim? And it's like, yeah, I can swim. And they're like, you're good to go. So, and then I was dive certified, but I never really worked the dive boats. I did snorkel boats, or I did sailboats.
Wow. So what'd you think about it when you got down there?
I love the Virgin Islands. I hated Michigan winters. That was like just to escape that was worth the price of admission for sure. But, and I love the ocean and you know, everything that came with it. But I also realized the island had more than its fair share of problems. I realized that almost immediately. But at the time I was like 18, 19 years old, I guess it's 18 years old. And, you know, I was just staying clear of that. I was basically working. I'd do 2 trips a day, and then what they called a booze cruise. On I think it was like once a week we'd do the booze cruise, where it's exactly what it sounds like. And it was like a night sail. And we had a great gig where the restaurants would we'd advertise on the boats for the restaurants, so we had free food. So I never like had to cook a meal or anything like that. I would just eat at the restaurants, and everything I owned was contained in a small duffel bag, and so. My accommodations changed quite often, and it was just packing up was really easy. So it was, it was a great time, but it was also a very directionless part of my life as well. So
well, I don't know, man, you kind of found your home there. It sounds like.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I, like I said, I love the Virgin Islands. I always will, but I also know there's a lot of problems there.
Yeah, we're going to get into those later in the interview. As you were growing up, did you have an adventuresome side to you? I mean, just to take off at 18 years old and go to a Caribbean island, you know, with what, clean pair of underwear and a clean pair of socks. That's all you got.
Yeah. And no money.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
I would say yes. You know, at that age, you assume everything will work out, and you don't, you know, as you get older, the reality of the world sets in. But at that time, no, I didn't have any concerns in the world. I figured everything would work themselves out. And my friends that went there to play music, they left long before I did. And, you know, I stayed behind and then after about a year, I returned to Michigan, and that's when I enrolled in college. I'd saved up enough money at working for Caribbean Sea Adventures that paid for almost 2 years of college. And so I did the 2 years, but then at the end of 2 years, I was broke again. And I think I had $750 to my name after I sold my car. And I used that money for another one-way ticket to the Virgin Islands and returned. So,
So I got to know, when that first trip you made down there, what'd mom say?
I don't remember mom or dad being like critical of it or anything. They were just like, yeah, whatever. And I do remember my mom, when I first told her, she thought I was joking. Like she didn't believe me. But then when, you know, I must have showed her the ticket or whatever, and she's like, all right, well, good luck with all that. And
so, really?
Yeah. So and when I returned to the Virgin Islands, you know, my plan wasn't much better than the first round either. I had intentions of joining the police department when I got there, and I had started the paperwork, but there was no guarantee that that was going to happen. And that trip was, I would say that trip was more, or that transition back to the Virgin Islands was more interesting than the first.
Where did the interest in law enforcement come from?
I don't know. I always had a very, what was the word I'm looking for? It's like an investigative mind, if you will. I enjoyed the, you know, trying to figure things out. And I was one of these kids that would rather take his toys apart and figure out how they worked rather than play with them, you know? And so I don't know where that originally came from, but I always enjoyed what police did, and especially what criminal investigators did. And I just, it always sparked an interest for me.
Did you watch Miami Vice and you thought that's what I want to do? I mean, no, be honest about it now.
No, I did watch Cops for sure. I did watch. Yeah. But, you know, I always had interest in wanting to do undercover work and I joined the police department with that in mind.
Tell you what, man, that takes some guts to do that, just to pick up and take off down there with really no money in your pocket and not knowing what you're going to do and not knowing where you're going to live. And I mean, that first night, where did you go that very first night?
On the return trip, when I went there the second time, I stayed in a hotel. That's kind of a funny story. So I stayed in a hotel that was kind of I wouldn't say it was a nice hotel, but it was not bad by any stretch, but I knew it was only going to be one night because I got in late. And then, I started inquiring where else I could stay. And not long before I had returned, Hurricane Hugo had devastated the island. Mm-hmm. And so they were still kind of in the rebuilding after Hurricane Hugo. And there was a hotel that had the top floor of it had been erased by the hurricane. And so the second floor of it was still intact. So they basically made the floor from the second floor the roof, and you could stay there. You had to change your own sheets and pick up towels from another hotel that was two blocks away. And so I stayed there for a short period of time. And then, but even that I knew was going to deplete the very limited savings I had. And so, I found it this one hotel that was, it was in the kind of the red light district of the Virgin Islands. And, there was prostitutes that mainly lived in that hotel. And there was a brothel that was either down the street or maybe even directly below it. And so I very rarely saw the prostitutes because they worked at night and, you know, I was sleeping, but I knew what was going on for sure. So, yeah. And that was kind of my first exposure to the Virgin Islands Police Department too, because there was officers that frequented it. And there was the rumors were there were high ranking officers that owned some of these places of prostitution.
Oh, Rick, you were going to say something there. I interrupted you, buddy. What was it?
I'm just relieved that I thought he was going to say something effective as he first became familiar with fishnet pantyhose. I'm like, thank God he said he became familiar with police and law enforcement, what have you. Yeah, I was worried for a second.
Oh, that's, you know, and I guess, and I don't want to get ahead of us here but I did read your transcript and I was shocked by the things that are going on down there. Did your first trip down there, you said you realized that things weren't the Shangri-La that, you know, you see advertised everywhere. What things did you see that first trip to the Virgin Islands that led you to think that?
Well, you heard about a lot of stuff. You heard about murders and certainly the drug trafficking during that period was kind of the heyday for drug trafficking. So you saw a lot of like open air transactions. There were obviously neighborhoods that you knew not to go into. And you know, even I was working with a lot of people that obviously they, you know, I suspected a lot of them were using cocaine and stuff like that. So, and that's when I worked for Caribbean Sea Adventures, and it appeared that there wasn't really any enforcement going on of any of these, this activity. So like even in town area, you'd see sometimes a half dozen guys, you know, hanging out in the street corner, and you knew what they were involved in. So, and you know, you read the newspaper and you read about homicides that, that occurred, and it was at a rate that was much higher than anything that I had become accustomed to living in the States. And now I know that, you know, the homicide rate in the Virgin Islands is like the second highest in the world. And it's like 8 to 10 times, that of you see per capita anywhere in the United States. So it's, wow. It's, there's a lot going on there, and a lot of it was drug related homicides too.
Yeah. All right. We'll get into that. So let's go over to Rick now. Give us a reminder, Rick, about where you grew up, all about your background.
I grew up one state away from Chris over in Ohio, kind of on the Appalachia, on the cusp of Appalachia, right on the border of Ohio, West Virginia, PA. And I kind of grew up as like a feral, I guess you'd call it. We're the latchkey kid generation. My mom was a school teacher. My father was a firefighter. And so there's like a lapse of supervision at times. But that was good. We lived kind of out in the woods. My friends all lived way at the end of the road, so I couldn't get in trouble as a younger kid. So I just grabbed my pellet rifle and take off into the woods and go plink cans and hike and what have you and all that. And that's kind of how I grew up until grade school. And I played a little bit of baseball, like Pony League and football. I think we had Peanut and Pee Wee in varsity league until high school. I got to high school and realized that 5'7" in a farm league doesn't cut it for any position on the football team. So I ended up becoming one of those band guys. That still got me out of the house. And, so that was pretty much it. I left home as soon as I signed up for the Army at 17, my dad signed for me. And, as soon as I graduated, I took off to the Army combat engineer, and pretty much I'd come home for summer times after I was done with the military, worked on a road crew, paving, running heavy equipment and flagging and getting some sun. And, that's how I kind of paid my way through the extra stuff. Army paid for college. All the little sundries, took care of it with that. And I also in college worked in a pet store and, Pets Plus, tiny little mom and pop pet store. Lots of stories from that as well, or whatever. But, so that was kind of an interesting job to have in college. And, that's my story.
You know, I want to ask about the pet store, but I'm scared too. I don't know what you're going to say.
Well, I would say probably
how many gerbils did you sell, Rick?
Lots of gerbils, surprisingly to fraternity guys. I don't know what that was all about.
Surprising at all.
Yeah. Lots of Kappa Kappa. What? They'd come in and ask for certain things. I'd probably say if I had to like just boil it down to a couple quick ones, the worst bite that I ever took in that store, was from all things, a guinea pig. It was this big, really? Fat guinea pig. This being a smaller mom and pop pet store, we would take in animals that people were, you know, like when to have adopted out, and we'd just keep them until somebody would take them. I mean, we still sold fish and this and that and the other. We didn't do dogs or cats unless they were going to be an adoption. And then we assisted in adoptions. Yeah, I think we even had like a free shot program for the cats and dogs and all that. But we primarily a lot of like smaller animals, you know, like, you know, college kids and bikers love their weird animals like scorpions and piranha and things like that.
Snakes.
I will tell you one thing. We, towards the tail end, my manager and I are looking out the window. We see this guy coming with a big 50-gallon blue barrel, like you'd put chemicals in or like a big water jug or whatever. We see this guy get out of this little minivan and he gets this thing, hefts it in there, comes into the store. And he goes, would you guys be able to take this Burmese python? I've had it for years. It's really nice. All I want is a 50-gallon tank and some gravel and the stuff that goes with a fish tank in trade. And I can see my manager's head spinning because that's a lot of money right there. That snake represents a pretty big investment. So he goes to proceed to get this snake out of the barrel, end up being close to 14 feet long. It was a full size. I think Burmese approach the 18 foot or whatever, this thing was massive. It was absolutely massive, but it was friendly. It knew him. I mean, I don't know what kind of, I'm not a snake psychologist. I don't know how intelligent snakes can get, but this thing, it like knew him. He had it around him. It was as placid and docile as you're going to find. And so my manager immediately says, sure, we can take that off your hands and we'll adopt it out to somebody who's, you know, knows their herpetology. And so they do their little barter. The guy goes away happy. He gives snake the pat on the head like it was a puppy or whatever. And we had to knock out like three or four of these giant cages that you could take sections out to put it in there. We made like a jungle setting for it, secure the cage because they can sneak out and what have you. Within 2 days, this snake was meaner. It was meaner than, I'm trying to think of a euphemism we could talk about online. It was pretty bad. It was like, you'd walk up. It was plexiglass on the front. You'd walk up to it and it would start doing this thing where its whole body would like come in and out like an accordion. And it'd be like this. Geez. And the minute you got within striking distance, that snake would smash into the plexiglass as hard as it could trying to get you, leave spittle on the plexiglass. And so we had this thing, a little girl walks back to the back, her mom kind of separated from her, and I heard it smash into it, and she runs out leaving a water trail out the store. And it scared her that bad. And, but anyway, so that was that snake. We end up finding somebody to finally, I never met the person. They got rid of it when I wasn't there. So I don't know how odd the person was, but I know that we sold it to a guy that lived down in a place called Findlay, Ohio, down below Bowling Green. And, okay. Years later, this is like three or four years later, there's a story about a man being killed by a python in Findlay, Ohio. And I mean, it was still back pre-internet days. I've always wondered if that was that big bruiser. Like the guy got it and bit off more than he could chew. But they found a guy dead in his kitchen. He had gotten like all stabby and whatever. It had gotten him. He had gotten to the kitchen. He had gotten like a steak knife out or a butcher knife. But the snake still wrapped him. And they found him and the snake on the floor of the kitchen, DRT, dead right there. But I've always wondered, I mean, what are the chances in a place like Findlay that big of a snake? And they described the snake. It had grown a couple feet, I think. But so there's a pet story. There's the pet show.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest with you. If I'd come into that pet store and I saw it strike, I'd have been like that little girl. I'd have peed all over myself running out of there screaming like a little girl.
Well, Steve, I'll tell you this much. Like, it had a weird feeding schedule. Like, as if snakes, I guess if when you do it scientifically, they have like, so you have to feed them when you have to feed them. And my boss had bought these fetal pigs that you can buy that are, you know, like coming like in a full, like a bag and they're frozen. You thaw them out and then you just get the snake. That snake it could probably eat live things, but it was used to eating those. But I know I had to feed that thing one time after hours when I was the only one in the store. Like I had to come back in from my apartment, come in at like 11 o'clock at night or midnight or whatever and feed this thing. I had the Smith & Wesson 645 Crockett. I had Crockett's gun. I had my 645. Yep. I had my 45 in one hand and a fetal pig in the other. I open up that back. It's like that bullets or bullets for gold, and open that thing up and just toss it in there and then close it. But I mean, that's how much I distrusted that snake, that I had a 45 in one hand and a fetal pig in the other. And so, yeah, I don't know. But some people love that stuff.
I'm scared. I don't even like to see snakes on TV. I'm just scared to death of them. I don't know why. I grew up a country boy in the mountains, and we saw snakes all the time, but they just scare me to death now.
Well, Chris, that's something we didn't have on St. Croix, right? Because
not at the time, but they have snakes. Them now. They've got them now. Someone let one of those boas go in there everywhere now. So
the mongoose population is.
Yeah, the mongoose population is probably the first to go. They're grabbing little dogs and cats now. So.
Oh, geez. You know, I did a TDY over in the Bahamas. We were in Freeport for 3 months on OpBat. Remember the where you flying around with the Bahamian National Police and all that? And they told me there weren't snakes in the Bahamas. And it's one day we were 24 on, 24 off, and I'm out laying by the pool reading a book, and something caught my peripheral vision, and there's a damn snake over there poking its head up over the concrete. So they tell you there's no snakes over there, they lie. So now, Rick, you how long were you in the active military?
I was in the Guard. I was in the Guard for 7 years. Seven. We did some overseas like tours, like we did Honduras. In Central America, back when Daniel Ortega was trying his little bid to find a warm water port in our hemisphere. The Russians were kind of working through Ortega to get their warm water port in the Americas and whatever. And Reagan was doing everything he could to counter that. So we were down there blasting, blowing up old bridges along the border so they could put, they told us as young, you know, as young troops, you're building these bridges for the pineapple trucks to be able to help the locals get their, you know, their goods to market and help build the infrastructure. But I was the guy who like blew up the old bridges. And then we did the quarry work to get the rock for the roads. But I got to see some of the new bridges that they were building at the regular 18 Charlie or whatever the bridge builders were making. Mm-hmm. I was wondering why these bridges, you could tell that they were the type of bridge you could accept an M1 Abrams or a Bradley fighting vehicle. I think the dull pineapple trucks have a pretty big load or whatever. But so that was kind of what we did, you know, in Central America. And then we did a tour in the West Indies, actually in Jamaica. We built a children's hospital. They took a bunch of combat engineers that are meant to supplement infantry and, like I said, blow things up. And we actually had a couple guys in our unit that were actually came from that background of building and construction and electrical. And so they took a bunch of us dunces, and at least we had a couple of cerebral types in there, and we ended up building a children's hospital just outside of Kingston. And as an aside, a couple of years ago, I was down in Juneau right before I retired on an operation down there for DEA, and I'm eating in a restaurant, and I noticed that the girl that was tourist season, the girl who was helping me, had the Jamaican accent, so we're talking, and I asked her, and this is a younger gal, just by chance, I said, is there a children's hospital? And I named the area that it was in. And she looks at me and she says, yes, my mom took me there all the time as a kid. And I asked her if it was still there. And she said, yes. So nice. I guess we did something right because it didn't fall down and it was still being used. So that was kind of cool all the way in Alaska to hear about that hospital that my guys had built. It's pretty cool.
Excellent. Excellent. And how did you end up law enforcement? Is that something you always wanted to do or?
Yeah, no, I was in college. I was kind of undecided. I had a couple of different ideas on what I wanted to do. But during one of my criminal, I took some criminal justice classes. And during one of those, they had an after hours, they had an FBI agent named Donald Vilfer. And Don came in and they had the class afterwards. Anybody who wanted to go to dinner at this big table, we could go to that and ask more questions, just talk it out. And so a bunch of us from the class went and did that. And you know, Donald talked about what he did. And Don's story was compelling enough that it made me actually veer that direction and decide to do that.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. That's one thing that I hope most uniform guys now or law enforcement professionals realize, that the impact that they can have on young people when it comes to deciding a career path.
I was going to say, when I got into the criminal justice program, it was competitive. So it took about a year to actually compete to get into it. But one of my first professors was that Bowling Green, that was one of their competitive majors. They knew they had you for 5 years. That was one thing that was a surety. If you took criminal justice, you were going to be a 5-year wonder. You're not getting out in 4. No one gets out alive, at least with their billfold intact at Bowling Green, if you do a competitive major. But once I got into the program, I had an adjunct professor, and he was one of the older FBI guys. He just retired, and that was kind of like his retirement gig, was being an adjunct professor. But he'd been a plank member of the FBI's SWAT team. But he's very unassuming, very nice, quiet guy, not like a gung-ho, ooh-rah, kind of guy, but super, super classy. One of the best instructors I had at Bowling Green, bar none, with no PhD behind his name. And so he was another deciding factor as well. Yeah.
Very nice. That's encouraging to hear. Okay. So let's go back to Chris here. You're back in the Virgin Islands, St. Croix, for the second time. How come St. Croix, not St. Thomas?
The first time it was just because that's where the musicians I knew were going. And then I guess I went back there because by that time I had some familiarity with it. So I wanted to return to a place I knew.
Which place is bigger?
I think St. Croix is. It's bigger. It's 87 square miles. I'm not sure what St. Thomas is. So,
did you experience any hurricanes while you were there?
Yeah, a bunch of them. when I was in the police department, sure.
What about before you joined the PD?
No. Nope. I missed Hurricane Hugo just by like a month, if I remember correctly. I left just like a month before.
That was a big one. When Hugo came through, I was actually not bad over in Freeport where I saw a snake, and they called and said, hey, the hurricane's coming your way. Go through all the pool furniture into the pool, secure the house, get out to the airport. The Coast Guard helos are going to fly you back to the States. And we did that. We secured the house, got out to the airport, put the cars in the hangars, and got another call. Said, Hugo took a different path, so go back to work.
Yeah.
So we did. Very lucky. I don't want to go through that. Not a major one like that.
Yeah, they're not fun. No. For sure.
And hey, Chris, didn't Hugo stall out? Didn't Hugo stall out over St. Croix, kind of? Or I mean, stayed there, right?
It stayed on, just continued to devastate that island. So it was, it's still, you could still see the damage of it when I returned in 91 or 92. And Hugo came through in 89, I believe it was.
89, so. Yeah. Yep. Dang. Whew. So, okay, so you're back. When you get there the second time, are you dead set now you're going to go apply for the police department?
I had already begun the process when I was stateside, and then I came down. I had basically gotten to the point where I couldn't do any more from stateside, and that's when I decided to come back down and continue the process there.
Well, I don't want this to sound racist or anything, but were there a lot of white officers on Virgin Island Police Department?
No. I think at that time, I believe there were two. That I can think of.
How many men and women?
About 250 in St. Croix.
Wow. Wow. How did that feel? How did they treat you as an outsider? You're not from the island. You're a white guy.
Yeah, an outsider for sure. I don't think really race played. I mean, I guess it may have played some role for some people, but being an outsider definitely, it was. It played a role for sure.
Yeah. So, how long did it take before you finally got that call?
A lot longer than I anticipated. The academy was, it started in the summer, and I had gone, it was probably a good 6 months before it started. And I was working odd jobs, just doing like washing dishes, wherever, some construction. My old bosses from Caribbean Sea Adventures were having me doing stuff at their house, painting and doing all sorts of stuff. So I was keeping busy, but it was a while before I got the call.
You didn't, you'd go back to the red light district to live?
Nope. I did. Well, I did. I stayed in that red light district for a while, and then I was working at a restaurant, and I met someone that was, two people that were looking for a roommate. And so I stayed with them. And then right before the academy started, I thought I was going to get paid right away and I could afford it. So I moved into just a very small, like a 300 square foot apartment that was just right next door to where I was. But what I didn't know is that they have to, like a notice for job personnel action or something has to be signed by the governor before you got paid. So I was almost through the academy before I got my first paycheck, which was pretty rough. So,
jeez. Their academy, do you live at the academy or you just go there in the daytime?
No, just go there in the daytime. And I relied on public transportation that entire time because I couldn't afford a vehicle. So there was a dollar bus that would take you from point A to point B. It would go from the town of Christiansted to the town of Frederickstead, and they would stop anywhere in between. And I think if you went the full route, it was like $1.50. If you stopped anywhere in between, it was like $1. And that's what I used. And it got off at a bus stop, and then I would walk about a mile and a half down a dirt road to where the training academy was every day.
That's like the stories our parents used to talk about. They had to walk 5 miles to school, and the mounds is 10 feet of snow on each side, and it's uphill both ways.
Right.
Wow. How many people were in your academy class?
There were probably 20, maybe 25. So.
And were you the butt of the jokes because you didn't have money, or were they in the same boat?
No, they were all in the same boat. No one was getting paid. So a lot of them, some of them had some prior law enforcement. Some had come over from corrections. But most of us were younger guys and gals, and we were all in the same boat. So.
And how long is their academy down there?
I'm trying to remember. I want to say it was 18 weeks. So.
Wow. Were you impressed? I think I know the answer now.
I guess at the time, not knowing any better, and I was 20, I think it was just maybe 20 or 21 years old. I didn't really know any better. I didn't have any expectations or mm-hmm. any perspective on what to compare it to. I really didn't, I couldn't form an opinion whether it was at the time, whether it was good or not. It seemed in hindsight, it didn't seem like it was that complete. We'll put it that way.
And did they have physical training also?
They had physical training, and that was pretty rough. They put us through it. We were doing, you know, we get a break every hour, and the break consisted of push-ups. So, and every week that went by, they increased it by a factor of like, so you maybe the first week it was 20, the next week it was 30, and you do these every hour. By the end of the academy, they would time us and how many pushups we could do at the end. And I remember I was doing 92 pushups in 2 minutes. So,
wow.
So yeah, definitely got you into shape. And we were doing a lot of running and that sort of stuff too.
Was there any type of language barrier for you?
In the beginning, yeah, I was confused, and the instructors made it perfectly clear that they weren't gonna alter their patterns of speech to accommodate me. So it was kind of like I mean, it wasn't like devastating, but it was definitely, there were times that I was like, all right, I don't know what they just said. So. Yeah. And then that same barrier, you know, understanding the island, because there isn't like street. I mean, there are street names to stuff, but nothing is marked. And so you get directions like head by the upside down tamarind tree, go up to what Pai Juni does, fix the car, then take a right. And, you know, like it was all like local references that if you didn't live there, you would never know what they were talking about. Yeah. You know what Pai Juni does, fix the goat dim. That's the yard. You know, it's like so in the beginning, but when I started, you know, in patrol, I got the hang of that very quickly.
Well, did they start you out with a field training officer?
I think technically they were supposed to, but that didn't last long. So a lot of times I was working solo even in the beginning. So,
hey, Chris, I never asked you this one. Did anybody wash out from that academy?
Well, there were several that were washed out that there was physical, firearms, and academics, and you had to pass all three. And so there were several people that were supposed to be booted out, and they disappeared for a few days and then showed up on the day of graduation and somehow were allowed to graduate. So there was something going on behind the scenes there. One of them, their mother was a senator, and so that they came back, and, so there was definitely, I don't think anybody, there was one that I can think of that threw in the towel, but aside from that, I think everybody got through either by conventional or unconventional means.
And how many were in your class?
I want to say it was like 20 or 25.
Okay. Okay.
Maybe 30. So
any memorable, funny stories that you can tell us about without mentioning names?
In the academy? Yeah. Not really. You know, the academy was like, I'd made up my mind from the start that I was going to get through it no matter what they threw at me. And I, you know, toward about halfway through the academy, I started getting rides at least home. But not really so much in the academy. Once I graduated from the academy, that's when the nonsense, you started to see the nonsense.
What type of weapons did they train you with in the academy?
Glocks, yeah, 9mm Glocks, and then they transitioned to 40s. So, and there were some old timers that couldn't qualify with the Glocks, so they were still carrying 38 wheel guns.
Yeah. When I went through the DEA Academy, that's what they gave us, was revolvers.
Yeah, yep.
And we thought we were hot snot too, I tell you.
Yeah, we had PR24s for instead of ass batons, and you know, Taser wasn't really around yet, so they gave us stun guns, which was basically just a torture device. It didn't never really work very well.
So I know in the Bahamas, you know, you would go out on these missions with the Bahamian National Police, and some of them had these old revolvers that you didn't know if the firing pin was still in there, or, you know, if a rat's nest had built in the end of the barrel. But these guys had only a few bullets. Did you guys have a shortage of ammo or no?
No. Uh-uh. No, I did. I do remember when I was chief of police, I did a weapons inspection of a zone one time and had everybody remove their magazines and take the round out of the chamber and hand me their firearm. And this officer hands me her 40 caliber Glock and it's loaded with 9mm ammunition.
Oh, geez.
So, so that one was kind of interesting.
You say remedial firearms training?
Yeah. So.
Oh, thank goodness she didn't try to fire it.
Yeah.
Oh. Wow. Okay. So And Rick, now you went military and then you were an investigator in Ohio for two years.
Yeah. For the state, through a county system.
You went to Pittsburgh PD. Is that right?
To Pittsburgh Police Department. Yes, sir.
How did you pick Pittsburgh?
I was doing that shotgun method because it was so hard to get into law enforcement in the early 90s. And I'd gone with some medium-sized cities and big cities in Ohio. And then I saw that Pittsburgh, there was just a notification in a newspaper, a local newspaper my mom and dad had gotten, that said that Pittsburgh was getting ready to, you know, start hiring. So I just drove clear across Ohio from Western Ohio and applied.
And how long did it take to get the job?
I'd say roughly a year. Yeah, probably close to 8 months to 10 months before I received the notification that I was going to go over and test.
Nice.
One of the things that when I tested, I remember one of the ironies when I tested is I'm sitting in a room like on a fourth floor of a building getting ready to go in and go before the board, before the interview board. This is after the test. And I look out the window and I see three U.S. Marshals walking across a parking lot with a guy in handcuffs. And that's where U.S. Marshals leading just a regular dude. Okay. Across the parking lot to this public safety building. But if I found that ironic, I'm sitting there interviewing for Pittsburgh, and that's where I jumped ship to when I left Pittsburgh was the U.S. Marshals. But I saw those guys at the beginning. They had the big U.S. Marshal on their back of their jackets walking across. Kind of like an epiphany.
Yeah. How long were you with PD?
3 years. Yeah, 3 years.
And so now you applied for the Marshals. Did you also apply for DEA? Because you weren't with the Marshals very long, right?
I did. I applied across the boards. I applied to Secret Service, FBI, all the top, probably the top four, top five, 1811 special agent gun carrying groups. I know that when I was down at the federal building for a bomb, I was near the federal building and there was a bomb threat. And so I just deployed to that, even though it wasn't in my zone, but everything was done. There was no bomb. It was all just a scare, but I decided to go up and talk to the Secret Service. I'm in uniform. So I go up to the fourth floor, fifth floor, wherever they're on, and just like it's a cold show up. And actually the ASAC came out, brought me back, and he told me that I was too young, and I just got a really bad vibe from the whole thing. Plus everybody was wearing business suits. That's when I decided that if I got a call back on the Secret Service thing, I was probably going to go ahead and maybe not think about it. But yeah. I know he's like, yeah, kid, you're too young. I think I was 25. Yeah, you're too young and come back when you're old enough. And if there's a degree of, like, I don't know, arrogance or whatever, but there's something that left a bad taste in my mouth when I walked out of that building. So I kind of like, you know, wrote that off. But everything worked out pretty well. I know I tested all the way with FBI and DEA. They're kind of in a foot race with Marshals, all three, you know, is like a test and then an interview and whatever. But I think, as I recall, when I was hired by DEA, Marshal Service, I was already done with DEA. I was just waiting for the phone call from DEA to yay or nay. And same thing for FBI, but Marshals won the foot race. And so I ended up going to FLETC.
So boy, you hadn't been out of FLETC very long then when you went to DEA, right?
I was still in FLETC. They break it up into two blocks. When you go to FLETC and you're going to be like, if you're customs or, you know, now if you're ICE or HSI, but they have the original phase of training, you may be lumped in with people from other agencies. And then you go through that basic criminal investigator phase. I call it CITAP or whatever, but you go through that. And then as soon as you're done with that, then you go off to into your individual agency to their specialized training. So Marshals run their own show. You know, everybody else runs their own show separately. But I had just made it to the end of that CITAP when I received the call from DEA. And it was not a hard decision to make. I knew that I was going to be going to Washington, D.C., and I wouldn't be going to the district court. I'd be going to like that D.C., kind of like because they're like the sheriff. Marshal Service are like the sheriff for the district. And so I wasn't going to be in a district federal court. I was going to be like in that. And when DEA came along, that's what I always wanted to do anyway, knowing what they do abroad in the mission and all that. So it was not a hard decision to make. Even my class coordinator is an aside. He's like, I don't even know why you're asking if you should, you know, what you should do. I would have been out of here like 5 minutes ago, kid, and whatever. When I approached him and said, hey, I've gotten this offer. And he's like, why are you still standing here?
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you if they called you a bunch of bad names when you told them you were quitting.
The guy who ran the academy wasn't all that happy. I think on that last episode, we talked about that guy. But the fellow who ran the actual Marshals end of the academy there, kind of like that Johnny Squarejaw, perfect hair, coiffed, you know, you just knew he's a corporate type. He was not happy, but DEA, you know, took me in and I was gone. So
there you go. What class were you? What class number?
112.
Yep. I went through class 53, and Javier and I spoke to the, we get to go to the academy now and speak to the trainees twice a year. And the last time we were up there earlier this year, I was in class 53, 253 was in session. Talk about making you feel old.
You know, I went back right before I retired. I went back. I was the guy that does the PT test for all the Alaskans that are going to go to DEA or they're going to test for DEA. Yeah. And so I went back to Quantico to like do the new how we do that now. So they train you up on that and you go through with a new academy class and you do the PT test with them. And I've tried to stay in good shape. So I could still do the running and the pushups and pull-ups. But I looked at these guys and gals and I'm like, oh, man. They looked like they were like sophomores or juniors in high school to me, you know, or whatever. So that's when you know it's time to pass the baton to the next generation.
There's college up in New Hampshire, New England College, that I've been working with them over, gosh, I don't know, maybe 6, 7, 8 years now. And they bring their CJ students down, criminal justice students down to Washington every year for a week. And they get tours by Metro PD and the Marshals and Secret Service. And so I got the foot in the door with the DEA Academy. So they go train, you know, they go see the Academy with the idea being that hopefully some of those students, when they apply, if they apply federal, that they'll go to DEA, and several have now. So it's kind of worked out, but it's just interesting to see these young people. When we go to the academy, one of the things they do is take them through the gym so they see the trainees, you know, working out. And the ones you see that I saw up there are all studs, the women and the men. I mean, they're in great shape. They got great positive attitudes. But SAC of the academy came by. He's an old friend, Mike. He comes one day and he says, listen, Murph, at this time we're going to do a ceremony where we're presenting the guide on to the class. You know, they've only been here for a week or so. They're going to get their guide on. And that's, you know, it has the name of an agent that they're going to memorialize. They carry that guy in with them the whole class, and said, you know, you come out, you're a retired agent. You stand in line with all our agents. You know, your college class will be over to the side watching everything. And he said, we're going to do a presentation. He's going to say some words to them, present them the guide on. And then he's going to introduce all the agents that are in line, including the retirees. And he said, so what we'll do, he said, I'll call my class, what my basic agent class number was, and then everybody will go down the line. And he calls out, you know, I don't know, 162, whatever he was. And then, you know, as it goes along the line, everybody's in the ones. And it gets to me, and I go, BA-53. And even the old guys in the line leaned over and like, who's this old fart?
It's kind of like when you're doing the scrolling, like if you have to do your date on your, you know, if you're doing like some type of application or whatever, yeah, and you're scrolling down, it's like never ending. It's like the person who spins a wheel and the price is right too hard. It's got to keep on going and going and going until you finally get there. And yeah. Yeah. Like a fine wine, you know, like a fine wine. Yep.
I loved it. I love going back up there because, you know, you get to leave at the end of the day, but it is like going back home. I love
it. It is. Oh, hey, Murph, there was something I was thinking about just now. Chris, I can't remember on the timeline or whatever where this gal fit in, but there was like the story you told me about like a predatory type. I think they would call them a cougar nowadays or whatever. But was that when you were still doing the diving thing, or was that after you started the academy? And
are you talking about the lovely lady we affectionately referred to as a sea hag?
That would be her.
Yeah, that was actually before I entered the police academy. So, okay. So I don't know. Should I go into the story?
Sure. You got our attention now.
Yeah. So there was, I talked about that 300 square foot apartment that I lived in. And it was kind of on a street called Hill Street, and directly across the street was a multi-story building. It was a very steep street, hence the name Hill Street. And below on the bottom of Hill Street, there's a couple of bars down there. And there was this woman that lived on the third floor of the building across the street from me. And like the first week I moved in there, I could hear people up. It was a flat roof that I lived on, and there was some stairs that could take you up almost to the roof. I could hear movement on my roof. And so I went out there, and there's two people that lived in an apartment next to me, and they've got lawn chairs set up on the roof. And I was like, hey, what's going on? And they go, you got to get up here. And so this was like a Saturday morning, first thing in the morning. And So they're like, the one guy that was on the roof, he goes, I know she got one last night. And I'm clueless what's going on. And all of a sudden you see this guy who's kind of in his underwear, he's got his clothes in his hand. And there were bars that covered like 3/4 of a balcony. And that was attached to this apartment where this woman lived, who we referred to as the sea hag. And the only way to get out of that, to the exterior stairwell, because the bars were locked, where the true exit was to scale along the edge of these bars and work your way to where the stairs were and get yourself out. Well, this guy all of a sudden surfaces onto the porch and he's got his clothes in his hand. He's looking around, goes to try to figure out how to get out, and realizes the only way out is down the bar or through the bars, and figures this out and starts scaling his way. And this is when it's explained to me that the sea hag would go down in the bars and get, you know, some guy in his 20s really drunk. And she was probably in her, I'd say, late 50s, 60s, and find the drunkest guy in the bar, bring him home with him. And he would wake up and in the morning and realize he's made a horrible mistake, and he would try to scale the bars to get away. And the guys on my roof had slingshots and a bag of marbles, and they'd start firing marbles at her aluminum louver windows to try to wake her up so she could interrupt this guy's escape. And the guy's like pleading with us, you know, to knock it off so he can get out. And to my knowledge, they never actually woke her up. It was more of a panic situation for him, but that happened like almost every Saturday for the year that I lived in that apartment. So that's the CIA story. Yeah. So
and that's what they call entertainment in St. Croix.
Who needs cable? Who needs cable TV when you have that, right?
Yeah. Oh, leave it to Rick to take that story down real quick. Yeah. That's why I invite you back, Rick. Yeah, some good laughs here.
I always remember the really poignant stories, you know?
The important ones.
The soul-searing stories, yeah. Yeah,
that's exactly right. All right, so we've been going about an hour now. So what we want to do is calling into today's episode. These guys are coming back tomorrow, so I'm hoping that you'll come back, because now we're going to get into more of Chris and Rick's law enforcement careers, how they ended up working together, how do they even know each other? And I know that. And if you watch Rick's first episode, you probably know that as well, because I think you did talk about Chris and another police officer down there during your first time here on the Game of Crimes. But for everybody, thank you for coming back every week. I can't say thank you enough. I truly appreciate you. You guys keep me motivated to keep doing this. We're into our fifth year now, and I'd certainly hope to see this go into the sixth year next year. So in the meantime, everybody stay safe out there. God bless. We'll see you tomorrow.